The first case for oral argument this morning is the Dakota, Minnesota, and Eastern Railroad Company Corporation versus Equity Mutual Insurance. For the appellant, Equity Mutual Insurance, we have Gary Timson and Jennifer Wollman, attorneys from Sioux Falls. I understand, Mr. Timson, you will go first, speak for 12 minutes, and then Ms. Wollman will speak for 8. Is that correct?
Correct, Chief Justice.
Very well. And for the appellee, we have Mr. Brian Donahoe, who will be doing the presentation, and Meredith Moore, you'll be present. Okay? As you can see from the bench, we have a few disqualifications this morning. Justice Sabres has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Larry Lovern, judge from the 5th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Sabres' place. Justice Konenkamp has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Max Gores, presiding judge from the 6th Judicial Circuit, to sit in Justice Konenkamp's place. And Justice Zinner has disqualified himself, and the court has appointed the Honorable Glenn Ng, circuit judge from the 1st Judicial Circuit, to sit in his place. At this point, then, Mr. Timson, you may proceed, and you have 12 minutes, sir.
I thank your honor. May it please the court, counsel.
I'd like to make a few brief introductory remarks. I don't have much time to give away. We don't have time for a moment of silence. I'd like a nod to acknowledge my classmate and friend, Brent Wilbur. I'd like to thank the court for having us here today. Ms. Wollman and myself, as the court noted, are going to address various parts of our argument. They are numerous. We may not get to them all. I just want to emphasize that if the fact that we don't discuss them doesn't mean that we are diminishing their importance or are abandoning those points for discussion. I intend to discuss for the court the coverage issue with acuity, the paucity of evidence on the negligence of the, quote, phantom driver, and the issue of splitting causes of action. Ms. Wollman will address the evidentiary issues pertinent to witnesses Radlinger and Selves adduced at trial in this case. The court knows this case was tried before the Honorable Robert Kim, a capable judge whose courtroom is always a pleasure to appear in. He's a good judge, but I think he made errors in this case. All of you at one time or another are or currently have been circuit judges and know about reversal. A reversal for errors made at trial is, of course, not a rebuke by the appellate court, but merely a different interpretation or application of cases and statutes than those defined by the trial judge at the case of trial. The first issue, I think, is that of splitting a cause of action. Acuity was formerly Heritage. They're in Continuum, and I'm going to use the name Acuity, of course, because that's the style of this case. DM&E had a commercial auto policy issued by then Heritage and now Acuity for its motor vehicles in the railroad business. Driving one of those vehicles back in 1998 in Pennington County was one Julian Olson. He was involved in a single vehicle rollover, which resulted in his becoming a quadriplegic. That spawned the first of at least four rounds of litigation involving that accident. The first having been an FELA, or Federal Employers Liability Act, case brought by Olson against DM&E. That case was settled, I won't go into the amount, by DM&E after some days of trial in Brookings County. Julian Olson is not now, nor has he ever been, party to the incident action. There were other then related lawsuits by Mr. Olson and by DM&E against manufacturers and so forth dealing with maintenance. And that brings us to this case. The commercial auto policy that Heritage Acuity issued to DM&E had a $1 million deductible. Now, DM&E paid its monies in the settlement of the case, FELA, to Julian Olson, and that separated him legally from Acuity. Like workers' compensation, it is an exclusive remedy statute against DM&E, and he, being Julian Olson, has never sought to make any claim against Acuity for any benefits. Initially, DM&E brought suit against Acuity under the liability policy. DM&E was granted summary judgment affirmed by this court on this very policy. After that affirmation, DM&E starts the instant lawsuit, now claiming that it, not Mr. Olson, is entitled to uninsured motorist benefits. We, Acuity, initially claimed, well, you're splitting a cause of action. This is one accident, one auto policy, and you litigated it once all the way to the Supreme Court. This is a claim that could have and should have been brought and litigated in that action. It
but
wasn't.
Isn't there a problem here? Say that Mr. Olson had to bring the action in his own behalf. Precedentially, if we were to accept your argument, wouldn't a tortfeasor have to sue both, or the victim have to sue both the tortfeasor and the insurance company simultaneously to avoid?
I think that's normally the case where you've got a phantom or unidentified vehicle, Mr. Chief Justice, and an auto policy. I think that's normally the way it's done, or at least the uninsured motorist carrier is given notice and an opportunity to come in and defend that tortfeasor, known or unknown.
But if your argument is carried to its logical extent, at least in my mind, you would then have to, in any tort case, join the insurance company in the primary cause of action against the tortfeasor, or you're subject to collateral estoppel or res judicata.
No, I don't think that's true. If A sues B, B is insured, or if not, A's under or uninsured carrier comes in, the action is defended. There is no direct action, of course, in our state in South Dakota, and there would be no preclusion. It's not if I lose the case against B, now I'm going to go back and sue B's insurer. That isn't done. And I think a critical point here is DM&E did not sustain bodily injury. That's the requisite to get uninsured motorist coverage. DM&E did not sue as an assignee of Julian Olson. DM&E sued in its own right to recoup its $1 million deductible under the FELA, and they tried first to use the liability portion of the policy. This court correctly stated no can do.
If they had sued as an assignee, would there be a different result?
I think that's a moot point, but
no, I don't, because this case has precedential value.
Yeah, but no, I don't think there would be a different result, Mr. Chief Justice, because Mr. Olson had been made whole. And this, in workers' comp, is the only issue or the only area of the law in which an employer can step in the shoes of its insured and say, I want to recoup the monies I've paid. FELA is like a bit like workers' comp. It's an employer indemnity statute. But the U.S. Supreme Court has said it is not a workers' compensation statute. So DM&E in this case does not have the right, statutorily or otherwise, to step into the shoes of its insured. Now, had Julian Olson insured, I don't think you might have that same preclusive effect because you have a separation of identities here. And I don't know, the policy prohibits an assignment without the insurer's knowledge and consent, so I don't think we'd get there. So I don't think we would have the same result to answer your question, Mr. Chief Justice. So this very clearly is one accident, one policy, one insured, and one insurer. And it should have been brought all at one time. An insurer or any other party shouldn't be required to stand repeated litigation every time its adversary loses and face a new lawsuit, a new trial, and a new round of appeals.
Didn't DM&E file its suit on the uninsured motorist before the Supreme Court affirmed?
I don't believe that's true, and if I'm mistaken in the record, Judge Gores, I think it wouldn't make any difference because I think once the court has spoken, there is nonetheless finality, and I don't think there's any authority for avoiding splitting a cause of action or dodging res judicata or collateral estoppel, any other type of issue preclusion by suing under the wire. So I don't think that's the case. If I'm mistaken as I stand here, I apologize, but don't think it makes a difference, Judge Gores. So
when was that actually, that issue raised to the trial court?
By a Rule 12b motion when we answered the complaint, very early on, and motion made and ruled on, petition for discretionary appeal made and denied at that point, Justice Meyer-Henry. But in concluding on that point, we have, as I said, two parties, one accident, one policy, and Acuity should not fairly be subjected to repeated litigation over the same set of facts, the same policy, the same accident. Another issue is that of coverage. I mean, Julian Olson, the DM&E is the insured under the policy. It is the named insured. And it does not sustain bodily injury, and that is the predicate for the recovery of uninsured motorist benefits. It's when somebody has sustained an injury and they are entitled or legally entitled to recover benefits from the adverse party. Because they are an employer, there's not kind of an inverse respondeat superior. They have no right whatsoever against the phantom and therefore don't accede to the rights of Julian Olson in this case. Now, as to the issue of the underlying negligence, it's always difficult in the case of a, quote, unseen or phantom motorist. And as I said, this accident happened on Interstate 90 in Pennington County, out near Rapid City, South Dakota, the morning of July 29, 1998. Of course, this court is looking at a jury verdict. And in doing so, you have to take all the inferences from the evidence most favorable to the verdict. Acuity is certainly mindful of that and aware of that burden, and nonetheless, it is our position that there is insufficient evidence as a matter of law, insufficient proper and admissible evidence as a matter of law to sustain that verdict.
Well, you have, if I understand the record correctly, you have three witnesses that say that phantom car was there, and you have no witnesses that say it wasn't.
You're exactly right, Chief Justice Gilbertson, and there's no dispute that the phantom car was there. But, of course, its mere presence doesn't indicate or militate at all toward liability. The basic tort law, there has to be a duty, a breach of duty, and an injury sustained. The only thing that anybody said in this case was that this phantom car was there and it was going slower than the other traffic.
2 minutes. 2 minutes.
Fine. Okay. Mrs. Shoesmith had said that it was going slow, but not under 40. It was in and out of the, it was in the brackets between maximum and minimum limits. It did not deviate from the line of travel. All witnesses said that the Olson vehicle successfully passed it, entered the passing lane, and was re-entering its own lane, well clear of the phantom, when for reasons unknown, it crossed over, hit the shoulder, and the vehicle overturned. There is no evidence whatsoever that this phantom vehicle, admittedly in the area, breached any duty. It was going within the legally posted speed limit, maintained a constant, a straightforward direction of travel in its own lane, and it had no physical contact or interference. I mean, it didn't veer, lurch, speed, or slow. So I guess to find liability, anybody that's going slower than traffic, if the traffic was moving at 90, somebody driving 70, if you accept this verdict, by their mere presence is going to have some liability in the event of an accident. So for those reasons, the split cause of action, the lack of coverage contractually, and the lack of evidence sufficient to sustain the verdict, Acuity, Ms. Wollman and I ask the court to reverse the trial court. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Timpson. Ms. Wollman, you have 8 minutes.
By way of brief introduction,
pull it a little closer. You're a little more soft-spoken than Mr. Timpson.
By way of introduction, I would just like to state that tomorrow it will be 9 years since I stood in this position before the court as a first-year law student in the Sam Mastin finals at the law school here. I'm pleased to be back, and I want to thank the court for giving Mr. Timpson and I an opportunity to present oral argument today. I will be addressing the issues of whether the trial court abused its discretion in failing to grant Acuity's motion for new trial for two reasons. First, prejudicial error was created when the trial court admitted the Barbara Radlinger statements into evidence. And two, prejudicial error was also created by allowing Michael Selves, DM&E's accident reconstructionist, to testify regarding high rail testing that he had done in the previous case brought by Julian Olson. First, by way of background, shortly before trial, DM&E made a motion to read the Barbara Radlinger statements into evidence. It offered an affidavit wherein Ms. Radlinger stated that she believed the recorded statements she gave to Chuck Woolock, which was DM&E's private investigator who investigated Ms. Olson's accident, that those statements attached to her affidavit was an accurate reflection of the witness of the events that she had witnessed on July 29, 1998. This affidavit also stated that Ms. Radlinger, in between the time of Mr. Olson's accident and the present, had been involved in an accident of some sort and had lost some memory of the details of the accident. Acuity opposed this motion, and the trial court agreed and denied Diamini's motion to present this affidavit to get the Radlinger statements into evidence. So shortly before trial, Diamini took the trial deposition of Ms. Radlinger out in Rapid City. During Ms. Radlinger's deposition, she testified repeatedly that she refused to look at these prior statements. She testified, "I do not want to read it. I do not want to look at it. Again, I don't want to look at it." When Mr. Timpson asked Ms. Radlinger if she had ever read or reviewed these statements prior to signing the affidavit, Ms. Radlinger testified, "You can ask Bob," who was the process server that took the affidavit out to her, "you can ask Bob. I told him to throw them away."
Well, now, if your co-counsel just had conceded that what we've called a phantom car was not a phantom, it was there, what is the prejudice of this affidavit to your client? Apparently the car was there.
Yes, Chief Justice, that's correct. The prejudice comes into play with the not so much the affidavit, but the actual statements that were read into evidence. DM&E, counsel for DM&E at trial, read these questions in the statements, and Mr. Wolak took the stand and read these statements into evidence. The prejudice, Your Honor, becomes threefold. First, Ms. Radlinger was the only witness to place a second unidentified vehicle at the scene of Mr. Olson's accident. This was the alleged vehicle that was following Mr. Olson's truck closely, and no other witness testified to this. Neither Holly nor Richard Shoesmith, admittedly witnesses to this, the events of that day, they never identified a second unidentified vehicle, and neither did Sergeant Scott Brown, who arrived from the Highway Patrol shortly after the accident. From this, DM&E was then allowed to argue for the first time that there was not one, but two unidentified vehicles that caused or contributed to this accident. It was able to argue in closing that this is negligence, you have another vehicle following too closely. And Judge Tim himself, in his memorandum opinion denying our motions for new trial, stated that the jury could very well have relied on the fact of a second unidentified vehicle to cause or contribute to the accident. That is the biggest point of prejudicial error, Your Honor.
Did the trial court give any limiting instructions when that evidence came in that fashion?
No, Your Honor, I do not believe he did. The second prejudicial effect is that Ms. Radlinger was the only witness who testified that this slow-moving vehicle almost came to a complete stop in its lane in the middle of the interstate. Again, no other witness testified to this. Holly and Richard Shoesmith both testified that that vehicle never varied its speed from their vantage point, and it never wavered or never did anything in its lane of travel. And then last, Your Honors, the third prejudicial effect is that Ms. Radlinger is the only witness to make statements of fault. Over Acuity's objections, the trial court allowed DM&E to read the entirety of these statements. Two excerpts are most important. The first is at page 62 of the trial transcript. Ms. Radlinger is stating, "Well, when I passed it, I took a glance over and says, 'What are they doing? Are they crazy? You know, you don't stop in the middle of the interstate. I don't care where you're at, you don't do it.' And the second, 'Because I'll tell you what, I think I probably would have followed them and said, see what you did? I mean, this is because of you. I feel this is because of them.'" That's at page 65 to 66 of the trial transcript. The cumulative effect of these three prejudicial errors, thank you, Your Honor, caused prejudicial error on the part of Acuity, and Acuity did not receive a fair trial as a result. Prejudicial error, as this court held in Carpenter versus City of Belle Fourche, is error without which the jury probably would have returned a different verdict.
What kind of evidence were you able to put in to counter her testimony?
Your Honor, we were not able to put in any evidence other than Mr. Olson's videotaped testimony and Holly and Richard Shoesmith.
How much information came to in front of the jury concerning her reluctance to look at this report?
That came in, Your Honor. Acuity read excerpts of her deposition testimony to the jury, and I believe so did DM&E. They chose parts of that deposition that they chose to read. But another point that Justice Meyer Henry brings up is what evidence were we able to bring in? And that leads us to Mr. Selves' issue, is that Judge Tim issued an order before trial that we were precluded from introducing any evidence of reports, testimony from the prior Olson case against DM&E or the Fairmont Tamper case. We weren't able to counter what Mr. Selves introduced as his videotape testing of high rail equipment as not being the cause of the accident. So we were precluded from countering that or rebutting that opinion in any way. And for that reason, the trial court's refusal to not allow the Mr. Selves videotape high rail testing was prejudicial error. The testing shown on the videotape has nothing to do with whether an uninsured motorist caused the accident. He admitted himself that he wasn't meant to be a reconstruction of the accident. It was only to show whether or not that high rail could have come down during Mr. Olson's accident. That obviously has nothing to do with whether DM&E is entitled to uninsured motorist benefits. And because Acuity was not able to rebut that in any way, the jury was left with the impression, we better look at this high rail equipment. I see my time is up. Okay. Thank you, Your
Thank
Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Wallen. Mr. Danhole, you have 20 minutes, sir.
May it please the court, counsel. It's important to note that this case here before you is about whether or not a jury trial should be allowed to stand, the one and only jury trial in which all of the evidence in regard to what happened to Mr. Julian Olson was heard and the facts decided according to the law.
What precluded you from bringing all of these facts to a jury the first time around?
In regard to the declaratory judgment action?
DM&E 1, in the, we'll call it.
Okay. In regard to DM&E 1, that was a declaratory judgment action where the circuit court would decide legal issues as to coverage only. And that would preclude, obviously, a jury trial. We could have brought causes of action together, but we're not splitting causes of action. We have two wholly separate causes of action that we're talking about here. First and foremost, in DM&E 1, we have the policy that covers liability of the DM&E. And it's a wholly separate policy, not involving uninsured motorist coverage, not involving factual issues as to who caused this accident, because the settlement that preceded that declaratory judgment action resolved those issues.
So they're two separate policies.
They are very much separate policies, Justice Meyer Henry, and it's important to look at the uninsured motorist coverage. There's a South Dakota uninsured motorist coverage, there's Minnesota uninsured motorist coverage. We're dealing with the South Dakota coverage here because the vehicle was principally garaged in Pierce, South Dakota. Mr. Olson was an occupant of that vehicle. Under the definitions of the uninsured motorist coverage, there's a section that specifically says who is an insured. An occupier of the vehicle under 2C of that definition is an insured. Mr. Olson, therefore, was an insured because this was a covered auto. There's no question about that because the automobile damage was covered by Acuity under the same policy. As to the DM&E itself, they're the insured because under 2A, the definition of an insured is you, meaning the primary policyholder or DM&E. There's been an argument here that DM&E doesn't have some right to recover because they can't be insured in this situation. Well, they are the primary insurance, or insured, I should say. They are the ones who paid the policy premiums. They are the ones who have the coverage here. They can't, as a corporation, have bodily injury. It would be nonsensical to interpret this particular insurance provision to say that DM&E does not have insurance coverage for an occupier of its vehicle when it goes ahead and takes care of that employee and makes sure that the employee's needs are covered. There's also a provision under 2D of that definition of who is an insured that says that the insurance covers anyone who has a legal right to recover on behalf of another insured. Mr. Olson is another insured. He was one who was injured. DM&E took care of him. They have a right, whether it be under contribution, indemnity, assignment, or as the primary insured. They have the right to recover in this particular situation. There was some discussion about a $1 million deductible. There is a $1 million policy coverage here that DM&E paid for. They could have brought the action in regard to the uninsured motorist coverage in DM&E 1, but that wouldn't have made any sense. That was a declaratory judgment action, and it was about different policy provisions, and it would have provided for more coverage and more recovery than the UM claim. Why is that? Because we were going after the policy limits and the cost of defense. It's important to note that in this case, the DM&E Railroad was trying to get Acuity to step up to the plate, get involved in this suit when it was beginning. Mr. Olson brought this Federal Employer Liability Act claim against DM&E, and DM&E turned this over to its insurance company, thinking that because there was a vehicle involved and they had liability and uninsured motorist coverage, that they would step in and take some action here to assist in this case. We get through all the matters in DM&E 1 at the trial court level, and Mr. Timpson is wrong. We then filed suit while the DM&E 1 case was on appeal and prior to the final disposition by this court, and we brought that UM coverage specifically stating that it was going to be a negligence action where we would have to establish the uninsured driver's negligence and that that negligence caused Mr. Olson's accident.
But say that the result in DM&E 1 had been the reverse. You had that $1 million coverage. There would be no necessity for this action, would there?
That's correct, and that's why we brought DM&E 1 first as a deck action, because, again, that would take care of everything. We would exhaust the policy limits, plus we would have the coverage of our defense costs in the Julian Olson case.
When you sued this case out, did you sue it out against the John Doe driver, the Phantom driver?
No, Your Honor. We brought it as a breach of contract action directly against Acuity.
Thank you.
We did clearly state in the complaint that it was under the UM policy and that we were seeking to prove the negligence of the unidentified driver. And I just would like to point out that this is not a phantom car case. There was no phantom car. There was a car. We just simply can't identify the driver. There was an effort by the Olsons immediately after the accident to identify this person by placing ads in newspapers in the Rapid City area where the accident happened. No one was ever able to identify the driver of that car. As to the facts of the accident itself, we do have a situation here where Mr. Olson was, by all accounts of the witnesses, not traveling erratically. He was driving onto Interstate 90 around 8 o'clock in the morning, relatively heavy traffic that day. There was a vehicle ahead of Mr. Olson, driven by Richard and Holly Shoesmith on their way out to Air Force Base, where they were both enlisted. On their way to Ellsworth, they suddenly came upon what Richard Shoesmith described as a deceptively slow vehicle in the right-hand lane of travel. They got around that vehicle, were able to pass it themselves. There was no traffic immediately near them at the time, but Richard Shoesmith was concerned because that vehicle that they barely got around was driving slowly enough that he was concerned that the pickup truck coming onto the interstate, which happened to be Julian Olson, might have trouble when it encountered that car. So he was keeping an eye on it, and that's why he's a witness in this case. He told his wife, we better watch that. She looked over her shoulder to see what was going on, and that's why she's a witness in the case. Unfortunately, they're now ahead of this slow-moving vehicle. They're not able to see the vehicles behind Mr. Olson. One of those vehicles contained Barbara Radlinger. She came upon the scene, and she testified in her statement to our investigator, Chuck Wallach, who has 23-some years of experience at that point in time investigating accidents and dealing with witnesses. She tells Mr. Wallach that as Mr. Olson got onto the interstate, he came up on this vehicle, put his turn signal on to make the pass, started to make the pass, and consistent with the testimony of the Shoesmiths, everyone sees the Olson vehicle get out halfway into the middle of the interstate and suddenly stop that leftward movement, stop the pass for some reason, and then begin after a short period of traveling in the middle between the two lanes, then suddenly to have to make a move to the left. That move to the left then brings him too far and into the median. He tries to correct, ends up coming back across both lanes into the ditch on the right-hand side of the road where the vehicle tripped and rolled. There's substantial evidence in this case to establish that a slow-moving vehicle was traveling not only deceptively slow, but negligently slow. And what happened here was that vehicle, for some reason, began to slow down dramatically about the time that Mr. Olson tried to pass it. The Shoesmiths testified about how this vehicle stopped right after the accident. The Radlinger statement indicates that it not only stopped at the accident, it nearly came to stop on the interstate in the right-hand lane of travel. and that she blamed Mr. Olson's accident on that vehicle nearly coming to a stop on the interstate. There's plenty of evidence here to support this verdict. More importantly, when it comes down to these statements and the evidentiary issues at issue, the evidentiary matters here are pretty cut and dry. You've got a witness who gave a statement. That's a recorded recollection, which is not hearsay. That's an exception to the hearsay rule. The federal rule is 8035. And in order to establish the credibility and trustworthiness of this statement, some prerequisites must be laid through foundation. There was a motion here prior to trial to see if that statement could be read by Mr. Wallach, who would be called to testify to establish part of the foundation. That was based on an affidavit by Ms. Radlinger saying that she was no longer able to remember the events or did not want to remember them. When it came down to the court's decision on that motion, Judge Tim felt it was not sufficient to simply have an affidavit, that the witness providing that portion of the foundation for an 8035 submission of a recorded recollection should be subject to cross-examination. Therefore, we took her trial deposition, and she clearly and unequivocally stated, that statement was true when I made it. That statement is correct. And that's what's required to establish the credibility and trustworthiness part of her vouching for the statement under 8035. She also stated that I gave that statement when it was fresh in my memory. There's actually two statements, but they were all taken within 10 or 12 days of the accident. She provided that information when it was fresh in her mind and when she was able to remember it. Then we have Mr. Wallach testify at trial, and he established exactly how he took that statement. It was an audio statement. It was recorded. There are a number of cases that find that when you have these things put together, where you've got foundation for the witness saying that it was fresh in her mind at the time she gave the statement, and it was correct, and then you have the party who recorded it saying how they recorded it and how it was transcribed and how it is accurate, that's enough. You've got a recorded recollection, and it's admissible. The exhibit itself, which is a statement, does not go to the jury. Justice Meyer-Henry asked about a limiting statement. The way that it came out in the course of the trial through Mr. Wallach's testimony, there was no limiting statement, nor was there one asked for by the defense. Later on, the defense was able to bring in portions of the Radlinger deposition that they felt would undermine her credibility, so that was fully vetted at that point in time. Mr. Selves also testified in this case, and Mr. Selves is an accident reconstruction expert. He is qualified as an expert witness. He's got extensive experience as a law enforcement officer. He's also taught accident reconstruction to the Highway Patrol and various law enforcement agencies here in South Dakota and throughout the United States. He's also a certified law enforcement officer, a deputy sheriff over in Yankton County. He testified in the case, and part of his testimony in this case and in the previous case involving the suit by Mr. Olson against the DM&E involves some testing that he did, which was not a recreation of the accident. He simply videotaped the high rail equipment and how it would be used, or how the wheel itself that was at issue in Mr. Olson's case against the DM&E, he demonstrated how that would not have affected the way that this accident played out. And the reason why he did that was test certain things to find out if his theories based on the evidence that he had and the calculations that he made were consistent with, in fact, the eyewitness statements and the other evidence in the case. So he had this videotape, which he presented to the court and explained to the jury, this is not a recreation. These are things that I did to test specific things. And he addressed what it was that he was testing, why he did the things that he did. When it comes down to it, there was no problem with the defense bringing in things from other cases if they wanted to. And they sure argued about all these other cases. And what was happening was basically we were trying this case with the folks at Acuity saying it was caused by either Mr. Olson himself being negligent or the high rail wheel on the vehicle coming down and causing the accident, or the phantom driver, as they call it, simply not doing anything wrong and this just being an accident. So we defended against all of those things, but the motion in limine that they're arguing is precluding them from bringing in other evidence simply said that they would first have to address that issue with the judge before it could be presented before the jury. Standard motion in limine, but we made it specific and said no evidence from any other cases unless it's brought up to the court first. We were acknowledging that there might be something relevant from other cases that could come in, but we knew we needed to address that before the court initially to ensure that there was no prejudice. Why did we make that motion? Well, we made it because there was no expert witness on the other side, and there was nobody to come in and testify as to foundation in regard to some of those other matters that might be from other cases. Mr. Sells was a witness in the previous case against DM&E, and so we knew that there might be some effort to attack his credibility through whatever it might be in other cases. But the bottom line, again, is we come back to this being the only trial where the DM&E Railroad was allowed to present all the evidence and establish exactly what happened in this case. And the jury came back and decided that it was, in fact, an accident which resulted from the negligence of the unidentified driver. He caused this accident, and that resulted in Mr. Olson's significant injuries. The policy limits are going to be exceeded in a case like this because the medical damages alone are far more than $1 million.
So there's no argument between you and the other side as to the extent of damages. It's just liability.
That's correct. It was stipulated as to the damages, Your Honor.
All right.
As to the argument that there was no bodily injury, I've addressed that. Clearly, a corporation is never going to have bodily injury. You need to look at the policy terms here to determine what needs to be done in regard to the arguments that there's no coverage under the UM policy. One thing I do need to address in addition to the procedural matters we talked about is there was some argument that the Federal Employer Liability Act was an exclusive remedy for Mr. Olson. It's not. There were other avenues for him to seek damages for his injuries, and he did that. There was a lawsuit against the railroad initially, then there was a lawsuit against the manufacturer of the high rail equipment. And that case was settled, as well as the DM&E case. But when the DM&E case settled, there was a clear determination at that point in time that the DM&E would be able to pursue any and all claims against Acuity. And Acuity was on notice of the UM claim prior to that settlement. They were also invited to participate in that settlement, and they didn't. Then Mr. Olson also reserved that right to go after the manufacturer of the high rail equipment, eventually sued the manufacturer of the high rail equipment and Ford Motor Company. And if you want to talk about assignments or however this came about, we would argue that DM&E is a primary insured, so you don't need to go that far. But even if you did, it's clear that Mr. Olson didn't have a problem with the fact that the DM&E was pursuing this action against Acuity. He testified in this case. Later on, in the bad faith portion of the case, which hasn't been argued here, but just by way of background, later on, Mr. Olson's attorney, Steve Johnson, was asked to testify. And so there was ample opportunity for him or Mr. Olson to say DM&E shouldn't be bringing this action. There's no question that that was fine with Mr. Olson and his attorney. As to the other arguments here, I think I've covered everything. One thing I do want to note is that Ms. Radlinger was very clear that it wasn't just some memory that she'd lost in regard to this. She lost memory because of the accident, but she did not want to remember this accident at all, and she was blocking it out from her mind. So this is a situation where she was clearly not going to be able to vouch for the accuracy of the statement and would only be able to vouch for it being accurate at the time. Her reading the statement wouldn't have made any bit of difference here, and the arguments in regard to that go to her credibility in regard to the affidavit, but they were allowed to bring that up in front of the jury and argue those issues from their deposition that was read to the jury. The evidence from prior cases, again, they still argued all those issues. They still argued about how this accident was caused by the other things involved, and the high rail wheel was argued right out of the box in opening statement. We had to address that. We did. The issue of Mr. Olson oversteering, I don't think was in the evidence, but the court allowed it to go to the evidence, and there was a jury instruction to that effect. They argued hard that it was sole cause of the accident, Mr. Olson's negligence. So all of those things were covered. And in the end, we have a jury verdict that's supportable, whether there is reliance on the Radlinger statement or the Shoesmith statements. We think they stand alone. You've got the testimony of Mr. Selves as well, all supporting this verdict. Once we got far enough into the case and found that the investigation of this accident wasn't sufficient by the insurance company, we also brought a claim for bad faith, and that's still ongoing. I won't address those issues unless the court has questions, but they were briefed. So if there are any issues in regard to the quashing of the subpoena, which we don't think is ripe, I would address those. But otherwise, I believe I'm done with my argument.
I I don't have a question about that, but I just want to make sure my note's correct. Did you say, in fact, that you could have brought the uninsured motorist claim in DM&E 1 and for various reasons decided not to do that?
I believe that from a procedural standpoint,
2 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honor. From a procedural standpoint, it technically could have been done. On the other hand, if we look at the core test under res judicata, were we trying to address the same wrong? Were we seeking redress for the same damages or wrongs? No. We're talking about two completely separate policy provisions, two different forms of decisions that need to be made on those particular provisions. So we did not. But yes, that's correct. Technically, we could have brought that as a single case.
I have a question. You say at one point there are two separate policies, and
yes.
Then you've said two separate provisions. Which is it?
Well, there is a set of written policy provisions.
But is there a liability policy over here that you made a claim on, and then an automobile policy over here that you made the uninsured motorist claim on?
Judge Gores, there is a master policy that contains all the liability provisions, and then there is a separate South Dakota uninsured and underinsured motorist coverage, which is a different policy, and it does not contain the same exclusions as the liability policy.
And mandated by law.
And mandated by law, correct. Separate one from Minnesota, also mandated by law. One other quick thing I want to make sure that I'm clear on in regard to the question as to whether we could have brought this in a single case, we could have, but again, had we done that, it would have had to have been bifurcated. There's no possible way to have the court decide the legal issues in regard to the liability policy without having a separate trial on the negligence involved in the uninsured motorist coverage. And that's why we brought it as a separate action. Again, would have solved everything had we won, because when we would have gotten the policy limits, plus we would have gotten cost of defense, and that's why we didn't do it.
Thank you, Mr. Donahoe.
Thank you.
Mr. Timpson, you have 10 minutes, sir.
Thank you, Honorable Counsel. I want to clear up a couple of things. The term phantom motorist, I guess, kind of became the currency of this case used by counsel and whatever. And I now appreciate your initial question, Chief Justice Gilbert said. Nobody denies it was there. I guess phantom, perhaps we should have said unknown, but throughout we referred to it as a phantom. So, yes, it was there. It was unidentified. It's probably a better term. Another issue, I want to be clear. There is but one policy here. I refer the court briefly to the appellee's own brief, pages 11 through 13. This is the first time I've ever heard an allegation that there is more than one policy. There is a commercial auto policy. It has liability provisions. It has un- or underinsured motorist provisions. They are different coverages within the policy. If that becomes an issue, I would like leave to submit additional authority, because that's a new issue that I've heard for the first time this morning. I think it's important to know that Julian Olson never claimed that the unknown motorist was in any way responsible for this accident. He testified in previous actions, and his deposition testimony was presented at trial of this action. Another issue that Mr. Donahoe raised is, well, Acuity knew this. We tendered the defense of this early on. Well, they submitted the issue in DM&E-1 under the liability policy. There was never a claim for uninsured motorist coverage because Julian Olson never claimed the other car caused his accident in his FELA action, so there was no reason for Acuity to have become involved or, quote, been on notice at that time.
Well, he couldn't have claimed that the other car caused it in the FELA action, could he?
Yes, Judge Gores, he could, because unlike workers' compensation, he only has to prove 1% liability on the railroad. So there can be concurrent causes, but if any amount of fault is on his employer under FELA, he could still recover. So, yeah, he certainly could have without precluding his action.
But there would be no reason to do it for him in the FELA action.
I guess that would be a strategy of counsel, and I don't know, unless they were looking at multiple sorts of recovery. And that kind of segues into another clarification I want to make. I'm sure Mr. Donahoe wasn't trying to mislead the court about it. When I said exclusive remedy, I meant exclusive remedy against the employer, FELA. And like workers' comp, certainly if an employee in the course and scope of his or her employment is in an auto accident, they can sue the third-party tortfeasor. But
they still have an exclusive remedy in workers' compensation against their employer. That's what I meant vis-a-vis the employer, not that there were no other avenues of recovery in the universe. Issue of the testimony. The Shoesmiths testified in the earlier case and again in this case, and their testimony was consistent. They were concerned, but the cause of their concern, if their transcript, their testimony is read, was the speed of the Olson vehicle, not the speed of the unidentified vehicle. And that leads us then to Barbara Radlinger. This was not past recollection refreshed. If I gave a statement 2 years ago and I didn't remember it, and somebody shows it to me and I say, yes, it's coming back to me now, that's one thing. It's quite another for Mr. Wallach to take a statement, for Ms. Radlinger to say, I'm not going to look at it. I've signed an affidavit that these people prepared that says I read it, but I'm not going to look at it. And for Mr. Wallach to say, this is not Barbara Radlinger saying, okay, I see it now, and even though I put it out of my mind, this is correct. She says, I've never seen those statements. Mr. Wallach had never seen them for 6 years till the time of trial, till they were transcribed. He never identified himself on the tape, and he simply says, I remember that this is what she said. And that is hearsay of the clearest order. There isn't an applicable exception. If the Radlinger testimony in these circumstances, given the manner of the presentation of her statement, the affidavit, and her trial testimony by deposition is allowed to stand, there really are no vestiges left of hearsay protection against acuity. They don't fit within an exception. Refreshed recollection is when I say, yes, I'm looking at my own statement, my memory's now coming back. I could no longer anymore walk out of this courtroom and say, I know that any member of this panel kept accurate notes. Well, how do you know? Have you ever seen them? No, but I know they did. Ms. Radlinger can't say those are accurate transcriptions because she has never seen them. So those things go, as Ms. Woolman said, to the very heart of a fair trial. There is absolutely no evidence of any liability until these conclusory statements. There were further objections on that basis, too. Look what you did. I think you caused it, or whatever they were, should have been stricken even if portions were admitted. The whole of Ms. Radlinger's testimony should have been out. Some of it coming in, there was additional objections made to the conclusory and unsupported statements made, and they were allowed to go to the jury. And that's the only evidence in which the jury in this case could have found that there was some action on the part of the unknown motorist that was in any way contributory to the accident that happened here. That would conclude my rebuttal, unless, again, this issue of two policies comes up, because it's new to me. I don't know if that's what Mr. Donahoe meant, but I would like to supplement the record because I truly believe that's wrong, if that's issue.
No one has ever chastised for quitting early.